Welcome once again to The Cosmic Citizen. This is your host, Andre Traversa, and again, my lovely co-host, Paula Thompson, is with us. Hi, Paula.
Hi, everyone.
We are talking today, and by the way, that was a lovely little piece of a song, Jesus Was a Tent Maker by David and Chapel Halt. And it's interesting because next week we're going to be talking about part four. We're going to be talking about the life and teachings of Jesus. In fact, we're going to have two shows on Jesus. Today we are continuing with our overview of the Urantia book in order. Sequentially, we are going to talk about part three. And part three, of course, is the history of Urantia. And with us to discuss the history of Urantia is a distinguished guest, Halbert Katzen. Halbert Katzen is an educator. He's got a law degree. He's done a lot of different things. But he's primarily known as the founder of a website called ubthenews.com. That's ubthenews.com, which, from what I understand, sort of attempts to try to back up a lot of the Urantia book's revelatory claims with current discoveries in archaeology, physics, science, and philosophy, anthropology, things like that. Halbert, welcome to The Cosmic Citizen.
Thank you very much, Andre. It's a pleasure to be on the show. Hi, Paula.
Hi, Halbert.
Halbert, tell me, if you would, we're talking about part three here. And by the way, before I forget, I want to make sure that callers can call in with any questions if they want. 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158. What I want to begin to do, though, here, Halbert, is just ask some very basic questions. Part three is called The History of Urantia. Why do we need a history of Urantia? What is missing in our current historical knowledge that needs some gaps that need to be filled?
Well, I think we're missing a lot in terms of our history. And, you know, for me, one of the most important things about a understanding of history is that it tends to relate us culturally. You know, pretty much all religions have their different origin stories that people relate to very powerfully as fact or mythology or however they relate to it. It creates a sense of identity for people. And when people have different creation stories and a different sense of their history, sometimes that can make it much more difficult to identify with other members of the human family. So I think on a practical level, in terms of, when I say practical, I mean practical in the sense of providing us something that will help us get along better as human beings to live in peace and harmony with each other. Having a historical account of humanity that we can all relate to can be a very powerful tool. And because the Urantia book provides a lot of information, of course, about the origins of humanity, and it also makes an extremely bold claim that the history that it provides will stand on the records of the ages to come. It is really, you know, it's like teasing us to catch up to its version of human history. And with advances in science and scholarship, that's exactly, you know, what's occurring over time. And that's one of the things that the UB The News project is really focused on is, you know, it's not just documenting the credibility of the Urantia book for the sake of documenting it. It's documenting this for the sake of being able to convey to people the extraordinary quality, the very unique quality of credibility that's emerging with the Urantia book. And then my belief is as people come to appreciate this unique and extraordinary quality of credibility that has so much to do with the verification of the historical information, then that will create a cultural identity amongst humanity in relationship to this book that will help us live in peace and harmony more effectively.
Okay. Halbert, let me ask you this. You mentioned origins. You know, of course, we know from the Urantia book that the book speaks so frequently about origin, history, and destiny, how those three things are so important. But part three is not just a history. It does talk about the origins, at least, of humanity on this planet. Let me ask you, the book begins part three by talking about our planetary evolution. What does the Urantia book have to say about our planetary evolution, and how is it? How does it differ from current scientific theories, and what does it have in common with them?
Well, scientific theories about the origins of our solar system do vary somewhat, but and I'm not going to claim to be, you know, the big expert in this particular subject area, but from what I understand, one of the main issues we're dealing with right now in terms of the origins of the solar system are that the Urantia book describes a system called the Angona system passing close to our sun and the gravitational pull of it causing matter to be ejected from our sun that then created the planets. Well, this passing Angona system is the explanation for why the planes of rotation are askew and why we also have some retrograde motion with some of the moons that orbit some of the different planets in our solar system. So it does explain some of that, but it's fair to say that as I understand it, a lot of scholarship does not support that particular view of the origin of the solar system at that time, at this time, I should say, even though many scholars do point out that this is typically how you would get the results that we see today, that is, things that are rotating off the sort of perpendicular planes and that, you know, have retrograde motion and things of that nature.
Well, let me ask you also, I'm not a particular expert on astronomy and these kinds of things at all. In fact, I'm really pretty ignorant of them. In fact, for the listeners who don't know, I happen to be blind, and this all is extremely visual to me, so it's almost a foreign language to me in some respects. But one of the things that my understanding is that most scientists currently support the notion of a Big Bang, and that is a notion that, correct me if I'm wrong, the Urantia book rejects. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it's definitely fair to say that that's true. It's not that there aren't perhaps some bangs here and there that occur and some explosions that, you know, would account for some of the things that we witness, but the general notion that it all started, you know, in one big clump and exploded is not supported by the Urantia book.
Okay. Do you know of any scholars who would agree with the Urantia book's hypothesis about how the solar system started, are there any scholars that do reject the Big Bang? Do you know?
Well, you know, the first thing I want to say about this, just you know, so listeners are clear and that we're clear in our conversation. There's two different subjects that have now entered our conversation. One is the origin of the universe, and the other one is the origin of the solar system.
Okay.
And it's important to remember that the origin of the solar system is what's really in part three of the Urantia book. Origins of the universe would be covered in part two. And so regarding, you know, the origins of the universe and Big Bang, there are, you know, divergent opinions, though the majority of the scholarship still seems to hold on to the Big Bang theory, even though it's losing some ground over time, it seems.
Okay.
But regarding the origin of the solar system, of course, that's a little closer to us and not so remote in time. And I think this is where, you know, these issues of retrograde motion and things being off the perpendicular axial planes of rotation as they go, you know, around the sun, this is where there's some real questions that are very much unanswered by scholarship, and everybody knows it. Right?
I hate to change the subject here, you guys, but this is really intended to be an introduction to part three, and you know, the history of the solar system, and this is all covered in part three. It's true. It's right in the beginning of part three, how the solar system was created, how the planet was created, how the physical aspects of the planet evolved. But it's all for a specific purpose to lead up to a point that is that this planet became perfect to sustain life. And at one point, the universe came and planted life, the seed of life, on this planet because the conditions were perfect, and intelligent free will life evolved. And I think the important thing to remember about the entire Urantia book is that the children of God, you and I, all of us, the free will beings, intelligent free will creatures, are what it's all happening for. The universe is deeply interested in the life on this planet, the human intelligent free will life that exists on this planet and that is evolving on this planet. And so I don't want people to think that part three is all about the origin of the solar system, because it's really more about the evolution of humankind. And as Hal said in the beginning, our systems of religion and civilization, how we grew up from primitive beings to where we are now and where we are going, and why is that important? And if no one ever validated the science of the Urantia book for me, if I never understood about even why the solar system exists or how it exists or why it all works so beautifully as it does, I would still be able to read that book and be thrilled and stunned by the insights I get from the information about us humans on this world and how we've developed and why that's important. Halbert, can you kind of touch on that? What has the Urantia book meant to you in terms of part three and the history, for instance, of religion? Because I know you have Jewish roots, and you may or may not have grown up in a traditional Jewish home, but the Urantia book, for instance, part three, says a lot about the history of religions, and especially about the history of the Hebrew faith. Do you have anything to say about that?
Certainly all kinds of things to say about that, but I think first, before I get to that, I want to respect this larger issue that you brought up, Paula, that of context. And I think it would just be good to first say a few sentences at least about what is in part three so that we get this show, started with some sort of a comprehensive, a brief overview that the Urantia book. What we find in part three is the history of Earth, the history of Urantia, starting with the birth of the solar system, and then the implantation of life as single-celled organism about 550 million years ago, and the evolution of this single-celled life into plant life, and then into animal life, and then into human life. And that the Urantia book says human life evolved about 1 million years ago. It talks about the whole migratory and genetic history of our people, mentioning that the different races that we identify or tend to distinguish as, having different skin pigmentation actually occurred from a single mother, a mutation, you might say, from a single mother who had, I believe, 19 children with varied skin pigmentations and other characteristics, and that this occurred 500,000 years ago. And then it talks about, I'll just say briefly about who Adam and Eve were, and that they had a genetic contribution to make to humanity that occurred 37,000 years ago. And that is certainly a shift in human genetics that is quite well documented and accepted at this point, even though the Urantia book story about how that occurred isn't accepted. It's quite well established that humanity took a shift approximately 35,000 years ago. And then this eventually leads to some general commentary about the development of religious life about in humanity, and some commentary about the development of marriage, and eventually leads to some extended conversation about Abraham and who a being called Melchizedek was. Melchizedek is referenced in the Old Testament, and one of the most intriguing things, I think, in the Old Testament is that it mentions that Abraham tithed Melchizedek after a battle. And as most or many people are aware, tithing is an act of like giving 10% of your wealth or your income or your spoils from a battle, in this case, to the church or the religious institution that one supports. And so when it says that Abraham tithed Melchizedek, it's indicating that Abraham had the utmost respect for whoever Melchizedek was, of course. And the Urantia book explains that this was an emergency bestowal because the belief in one God was losing ground on our planet. And that this is Melchizedek is like a very high order of angel who functions in emergencies and came in an incarnate form, in a bodily form. And that in this case, the Urantia book and the Old Testament are quite consistent in saying that he lived approximately 90 years and entered the planet without lineage and left mysteriously. And then, you know, this starts to lead us up to part four, the life and teachings of
right.
Jesus,
Although,
of course.
However, let me, I'm glad, and by the way, Paul, I'm glad you interjected to talk about the origin of human life, because that's one of the next questions I was going to ask about Halbert about, which is, that the, you know, what does the Urantia book say about biological evolution, not just the origin of the solar system, because biological evolution is covered in part three. We know that there were certain beings that came here called life carriers who implanted life here. But let me ask you this, Halbert. Oh, first, let me also just remind listeners again that if they have any questions for Halbert or for either one of us or about any of these subjects, please call in 646-716-8158. That's 646-716-8158.
Before we jump on, Andre, could I just finish up saying one more thing about what's in part three? Because I think otherwise we may lose it altogether
because
it doesn't really have to do so much with the history of our planet. And that is that section three ends up with five exquisite chapters on philosophy that most Urantia book readers find to be just some of the most rich and intriguing and beautiful and inspiring sections of the book, and that these five chapters almost don't rely at all on any of the previous theology that was, you know, expressed in earlier sections of the book. They're really some sections that stand on their own quite nicely. And then after that, there's five chapters on the indwelling spirit of God.
Yeah.
And again, these are also considered some of the most beautiful and exquisite and informative chapters in the whole book, and are a very important part of section three that most Urantia book readers just love. So, you know, it's very interesting to me that, you know, after recounting human history this way, some of the very last chapters in the Urantia book really bring it back home spiritually to describe in really a lot of detail about our relationship to the indwelling spirit of God and how this creates our soul and the, you know, significance and implications of all of this. And so I just wanted to, you know, interject that before back to your question about the evolution.
Okay, let me tell you what I was going to ask.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
What I want to ask, and Paula, please feel free to jump in anytime you'd like. What I was going to ask is this, and I don't want to keep beating this issue to death, but because you do this site, You Be the News, and you follow the current scholarship, current scholarship on evolution, from what I understand, the general consensus is that human beings had their origin in Africa. Now, according to the Urantia book, human beings originated in Asia. Are you aware of any scholars who might support that idea that human beings originated in Asia, or is everybody pretty much sold on the Africa thesis?
Well, you know, first to say, it's a big world, and there probably are some scholars out there who think differently than, you know, what is espoused in the out-of-Africa theory or you know, that model. I don't know them off the top of my head, but I would venture to say that there are, you know, a good number of scholars who are not altogether satisfied with the out of Africa model, and we're increasingly making discoveries that really undermine that theory. But, you know, old theories die slowly, of course, the joke being that old theories never die, just the people who hold them do, right? So, you know, often people do kind of stake their reputations on things, and unless a new theory that can be put out that better explains everything, again, sometimes it's hard for these older theories to die out, even though there's abundant evidence that contradicts them. And so we're in a very evolutionary, if you will, aspect of our sciences at this point. But, you know, it is important to say, you know, just to be clear, of course, that obviously the Urantia book supports evolution and considers evolution simply God's technique of creation. And it's, of course, very challenging to figure out things that happened a half a million years ago or a million years ago. It's not like we've dug up the whole earth and found all of the archaeological remains that could possibly be found, and now we're trying to make sense of them. Quite to the contrary, we, you know, get little bits of information here and there when archaeological sites are excavated that, you know, where we're fortunate enough to get some good artifacts. But genetics, of course, is a very recent field of human science, and the archaeological sites are, you know, providing new discoveries all the time, and we're finding new sites and always adding to our general understanding of the evolution of human society and the history of human life on the planet. So things are changing all the time, and, you know, fortunately they tend to change very nicely in relationship to what the Urantia book says. Just as a little for instance, just a couple days ago, really this week, I was finishing up a report on early occupation of Britain. Well, here's where the Urantia book says that human beings inhabited Britain 900,000 years ago. Well, up until about 2000, it was believed that human beings hadn't reached that section of Europe until about a half a million years ago. And just in the last several years, about 5 years ago or so, or a little more, I mean, it comes out in bits. But to cut to the chase, that number got pushed back 200,000 years just in this last decade. So obviously that's, you know, heading towards what the Urantia book says in terms of 900,000 years. And not only that, but it is verifying what it essentially states that, you know, 700,000 years ago, this, you know, part of the world was inhabited as well. So even though they haven't got the whole thing yet, the recent archaeological finds do support what the Urantia book said back in 1955. That wasn't really confirmed until just, you know,
Let me ask you this. The first human beings, according to the Urantia book, were not Adam and Eve, in contrast to the Bible. The first human beings were two people called Andon and Fanta. What did the book say about them?
Well, one of the things that it says is that they evolved suddenly. That is that I believe that the word that's used is that they were radically, quote-unquote, radically different from their parents, more intelligent, taller, things of this nature. You know, they had a different physiology. And this gets to the, you know, general issue that, again, here's where science is starting to support what the Urantia book says in a rather dramatic way, which is we're starting to find in the genetics sections of the genetic code that exist even in single-celled organisms that seem to be related to unleashing mutations. So it's really quite extraordinary to find something like that, to find something that essentially indicates that even with the first single-celled life, there was inherent in that life the possibility and the, in a sense, structure for, or the design, if you will, the design for mutative evolution, you know, to have marked steps of mutation that would dramatically change the life form that, you know, originated it. So, you know, it's really quite a fascinating part of genetics that we're just starting to understand, but it really seems to support very well what the Urantia book says, which, of course, is that life was, you know, implanted or created on this planet, designed to evolve, you know, and that once the, as the beings are called, the life carriers created that design for life on Urantia, they had to step back. That was part of their mandate, you know. They ran all kinds of experiments and did all kinds of things before they determined what type of life to implant on Urantia. But once they did that, they had to just watch it evolve and, you know, not interfere with the design that they had created.
You know, Halbert, I think you touched on probably a key concept throughout the entire book that I have identified, and that is the concept of evolution, that all things must evolve, and that evolution is not a fast process, that some changes can happen suddenly. But overall, evolution is a very slow, methodical, time-tested, sound technique of God and creation to take something from one stage, from a primitive stage, to an advanced stage. And the history of Urantia is really about our planet's evolution. And in my, as I look at it, it's almost like a therapy session for the world. Because, you know, you go into therapy to find out the things that happened that kind of got you stuck here or there along the way as you grew up. A lot of people do anyway.
Right,
and
right.
Almost as though the beings that brought us the Urantia papers brought us this history so that we could see how our planet has evolved. First of all, they tell us how a normal planet evolves, and then they tell us how we evolved, and they kind of show us, well, they absolutely show us where we're out of step with a normal evolutionary planet, but then they give us very practical ways to get back in step. For instance, they give us that wonderful paper called Government on a Neighboring Planet. That's in Part 3. They tell us they don't ordinarily reveal what's going on one planet to another planet, but in this case they gave us this particular example because this planet is very similar to us, and yet they've been able to figure out some things that we haven't been able to figure out. So I think that concept of evolution is so paramount, and the Urantia book fleshes that whole concept out in such a way that it really becomes understandable for just about anybody, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, Proc is the name of the game, and that's definitely what's happening, you know, and the recounting of that in the Urantia book, definitely. I love your analogy to therapy. It definitely, you know, has some of that aspect of going back to the past and getting some things cleared up so that we can move forward a little more easily and from a more solid appreciation of who we are and where we've come from and how we can work with that, you know, and use it to support us as we move forward into the future.
Yeah. Paul, Halbert, I want to, it's funny, just to kind of build on Paula's point. The book talks a lot about the interaction between evolution and revelation, and that periodically in a planet's history, evolution is guided by or interrupted by or jump-started, if you will, by revelation. That's one of the reasons that the Urantia book is given to us, to kind of help gently push our evolution forward a little bit. Okay, it's a revelation. So revelation guides evolution, and evolution influences revelation. It's kind of one of those things that I think is a real key concept in the book. But there are three particular revelations that are covered in part three. The first three epochal revelations to our planet. The first one being the planetary prince. The second one being Adam and Eve. The third one being Melchizedek. If we could talk about each of those, who was the planetary prince and what was his purpose?
Do you want to play with that, Paula, or do you want me to?
Well, go ahead, Albert. I mean, you're the best.
Okay, sure. Well, it's all fine. The planetary prince is part of the general administration of an evolving world. And one of the unique things about our world being what's referred to as an experimental world, a decimal planet, that every 10th planet they can try to make some changes to upgrade the forms of life that are created in God's universe, that normally a planetary prince comes at the very beginning of human history. But on a normal world, the various colored races, the different pigmented races, evolve before actually humanity evolves. And on our world, that was reversed. So we had human beings before we had the different colored races. And our planetary prince did not come until the colored races evolved about 500,000 years ago. And I will say that, to my knowledge at this point, there's really nothing in our sciences that are supporting this too particularly right now. I've been keeping an eye out, but I, really haven't found much there. But the planetary prince comes and is here to help us develop, and he has a corporal staff, a staff of 100 incarnate beings. The planetary prince himself being invisible to human beings, but his staff is visible and is organized to help promote the social development of the planet. So the staff, divides into different camps, if you will, or groups that, promote industry or promote hygiene or promote social relations or, these different aspects of society and government and spirituality and these basic institutions of human life are said to be guided by this staff of the planetary prince, which really goes to show you what, the downreach plan is like and what it's, intended to do. Of course, we had a rebellion on this planet, and our planetary prince went into the rebellion, and so we don't have this history in our records until we get another epical revelation like the Urantia book to let us know about it again, having lost it because the history is so long ago and before, people were reading and writing and printing books to preserve human knowledge. So the planetary prince, comes to establish the divine government on a planet, and that did occur and persisted for, about 150 or 200,000 years until the rebellion occurred. And so we have a period of our human history where things were evolving and moving forward quite well until the rebellion, and then that, of course, threw things.
Well, we did cover the rebellion last week, but it wouldn't hurt to discuss it again a little bit.
Andre, before you go on to the rebellion, I just want to touch really quickly on how Halbert talked about the original organization of that the planetary prince comes down with his core, and they set up the rudimentary, the beginnings of civilization. And I just want to say what they are. One is the Council on Food and Material Welfare. Two, the Board of Animal Domestication and Utilization. Three, the Advisors Regarding the Conquest of Predatory Animals. Four, the Faculty on Dissemination and Conservation of Knowledge. Five, the Commission on Industry and Trade. 6, the College of Revealed Religion. 7, the Guardians of Health and Life. 8, the Planetary Council on Art and Science. 9, the Governors of Advanced Tribal Relations. And 10, the Supreme Court of Tribal Coordination and Racial Cooperation. So those are what the very beginnings of human civilization, and of course they are expounded upon in wonderful detail, I think, in the Urantia book.
Yeah.
I wonder what was here to do. Go ahead, Andrea.
Yeah, I think, you know, and of course if our planet had evolved normally, we would be we would have access to all that. We would have a superhuman administration here. But our planet unfortunately didn't evolve normally, and there was rebellion here. And we did cover that last week when we spoke with Michelle Clemish on part two, but it wouldn't hurt to kind of review it again a little bit in relation to our individual planet. One of the things that it's interesting because, Halbert, as you specialize in how current scholarship lines up with the Urantia book, this isn't really scholarship, but C.S. Lewis wrote a science fiction trilogy called the Space Trilogy. And interestingly enough, I think in the last book, I didn't read the last book, but it's called That Hideous Strength. In that book, there's a place where he says, the planetary prince is crooked. So it's interesting how I kind of wonder, you know, did he have some kind of supernatural revelation or what happened? But anyway, what exactly, who was our planetary prince and what did he do that screwed us up?
Well, the fundamental screw-up, of course, technical term screw-up, the fundamental screw-up was denying the existence of our Heavenly Father. That's really what it all comes down to, is whether it's, you know, higher orders of beings or mortal beings, we all have to have a little faith, you know? And there are reasons why, and the Urantia book, of course, explains extensively why this faithfulness is so important. And it can be very confusing for us as mortals to appreciate how high orders of celestial beings who are so well endowed with various intellectual capacities and you know, physical endowments and so forth to, you know, function in the universe at a high, you know, order of existence that we can't hardly even imagine, would come to reject having faith that we are all children of God. But it just goes to show you the exquisitely balanced way that our Heavenly Father creates life, that on this kind of spiritual level, there's a real sort of equality, if you will, that is equality in terms of the need to have faith. And the rejection of the existence of the reality of us all being the children of God, of the Universal Father, is the fundamental disloyalty or betrayal of trust. And then, of course, with that came the usurpation of deity prerogatives, if you will, or that is, the choices that God should have. And so Caligaster, our planetary prince, tried to set himself up as the god of Urantia. And that is one way, at least, to, you know, summarize what the problem was.
And of course, Caligaster's rebellion was part of a larger rebellion, which he was following Lucifer and Satan.
Okay, and let's be clear too that Caligaster, for somebody who might be listening that's never heard that word before, is the name, the celestial name of the being that we know as the devil or the prince of darkness. And the Urantia book says that he is literally real, and he literally did take our planet in to darkness. He was in charge. He could have chosen not to go with the rebellion. There was a rebellion in our system. He chose to go with the rebellion. And the other thing that I want to point out, and Halbert, you said that his denial of the existence of the Heavenly Father was certainly key in the rebellion, but also it was a form of self-love, which the Arantia book really does talk about Lucifer, too, and how he fell just so totally in love with himself and you know, his own abilities and his own brilliance. And I think Caligastia had that, too. It's self-love. It's the Arantia book calls it unbridled self-liberty, this idea that you can do whatever you want and there's nothing to stop you. And, you know, so I think that's an important point, too.
And, you know, maybe this is a good time to talk about the distinction between rebellion and default and how that relates to a little bit, you know, later segment of our human history having to do with Adam and Eve. Because there...
Wait, before you go any further, Howard,
sure.
let's tell the listeners who Adam and Eve were, because I think just in case we have people listening who are not familiar with the book, a lot of people think Adam and Eve were the first people on Earth, and we already clarified that they were not. So who were they? What was their mission?
Right. So their mission, or one aspect of their mission, we should say, and one of the most important aspects of their mission, was to be biologic uplifters. That is, according to the Urantia book, human evolution proceeds at a certain pace and then eventually plateaus. So just as an example, it talks about how human evolution is not complete, that we're still, for instance, evolving towards having 28 teeth, which is why so many people have to have their wisdom teeth pulled out, because, you know, we're still in this transition stage. But nonetheless, we reach a general apex. And at that stage, it is the general plan for all inhabited planets throughout the cosmos to receive an order of beings that are generally referred to as an Adam and Eve, and or an Adamic pair. And the idea is that these beings who come from a different world and incarnate on a mortal sphere like ours, then have a dual system. They have a physical circulatory system, but also a more spiritual type of circulatory system. And this is what relates to the Tree of Life mythology in our religious traditions. The Urantia book supports the notion that that Adam and Eve were able to remain immortal on this planet before they went into default, at least, because they ate from this tree that sustained their unique type of energetic system. But the general idea is that they would have children, and then their children would have children, and they would create a new race, and get, I think, to about 500,000 in population size before they would start to migrate out into the rest of the world and mate with the mortal races and biologically uplift humanity even further. So the default of Adam and Eve was to try to accelerate that process outside the prescribed guidelines for how to do that. I don't know if we want to get into
that. Well,
I want
to make sure that the listeners understand something, though. Adam and Eve were not human beings as we understand them. They were material beings, but they were what were called material sons and daughters.
Yeah.
Material sons and daughters are a special order of being who come down here from another world, Jerusalem, and they are 8 feet tall. They have violet skin. I mean, this may sound very bizarre to listeners who are not familiar with it, but essentially, they are biological evolution was jump started by genetically superior beings who were supposed to come here and contribute, as you said, genetically to our planet. You can go ahead and tell us about the specifics of what happened there. I mean,
but before you go on, back up a little bit, and so people understand. By the time Adam and Eve got here, the planet was in full-blown rebellion.
That's true.
The original 100, the cores that came down to establish civilization, as we described earlier, had gone into rebellion. A full 60% of those 100 went into rebellion, and the other 40%, all save one, were taken back to the worlds on high. And so, here we are in this very dark, dismal situation, and these two beautiful material beings are brought here to help upstep the planet, but they have their work cut out for them, and it's no easy task. The garden, their home, their civilization had already been prepared for them by the one loyal member of the Corps, being the book names as Van, and there are legends of Van all throughout the Mesopotamian region, and a loyal human associate by the name of Amadon, and they worked for thousands of years to create this garden, sustained by the Tree of Life, their energy and their life sustained by the Tree of Life. And so I think it's important to give a little background to what Adam and Eve faced when they got here. They didn't do a very good job, but the odds were against them, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, I want to mention at this point, I don't know if we want to get deeply into it now or later in the conversation, but interestingly enough, it's this story of Adam and Eve that today provides us some of the most dramatic cooperations of the Urantia Book's history that are coming through advances in the sciences. And in fact, just about 4 years ago now, out of the University of Chicago, a genetics report was published that parallels the Adam and Eve story in six different ways and also has a correlation to the very first human beings. So this is really, you know, quite extraordinary, and it took, of course, very significant advances in genetics to develop, you know, this science and these correlations. But one of the things that the Urantia Book says that Adam and Eve's genetics contributed was an enhancement to brain function.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Albert, because I just saw something about that by a writer named Joseph Chilton Pierce, who said that 40,000 years ago, he put it at 40,000, but 40,037, that there was a great jump in cortical development, cerebral cortical development, in the human brain. So that's already been established by scientists. They don't know why it happened, but it's just very interesting you brought this up. Go ahead and expand on that, if you will.
And I love Joseph Chilton Pierce's book, Magical Child. I just
he's great. He's great.
Saying it's one of my favorite books on the planet. You know, read it a couple times. But any rate, yes. These researchers were focused in on the part of our genes that produce microcephalin, which is responsible for the growth of the brain when we're in utero. And they noticed that 70% of the current human population, they had a representative cross sample of the current human population, and they noticed that 70% of us have this extra little piece sticking on our microcephalin gene. And they thought, wow, you know, how peculiar, but let's study it. And, of course, because geneticists have gotten very sophisticated about understanding how genes pass from generation to generation and amongst populations, they're able to extrapolate backwards in time, asking, what in all likelihood must have happened in the past to give us what we're looking at today? So this was the nature of the research that these geneticists were doing on the microcephalin gene. And they concluded that this extra little piece sticking on the microcephalin gene, that they have no idea what it does, but that they have concluded that it was likely introduced, and this is their number, approximately 37,000 years ago. And the Urantia Book says that Adam and Eve arrived 37,848 years ago. Now, the geneticists say to get to 70% of the human population in 37,000 years is very fast. That's not just drifting along casually through the, you know, gene pool. That's really moving. And in their terminology, they would call it positive selection. In Urantia Book, you know, terminology, we call it an upgrade, an intentional, orchestrated, planned for, and carried out upgrade.
How do geneticists know that 70% of the human population has this extra
Right, because what they had was a representative cross-sample of the current human population.
Okay.
Yeah, so they were looking at, you know, everyone's genes around the world, you know, particularly this microcephalin gene. And they're sophisticated enough in their research techniques to make determinations about whether something like this entered the human population from a single source and a single individual, or did a whole population have it and then eventually mix with other populations.
Okay.
And they conclude that it coalesces back to a single source, of course not statistically different than a single pair of individuals.
Okay.
They say that it originated in Mesopotamia, and of course the Urantia book is specific about where. They say that less of it got into sub-Saharan Africa, and the Urantia book mentions that Adam and Eve's descendants didn't travel as much or so much into sub-Saharan Africa. And then here's where one of the little bonuses that I just love about this particular genetics report as it relates to the Urantia book is that they studied this microcephalin gene is in a group of other genes related to the brain. And so they studied these ones around the microcephalin gene to do cross-comparative analysis, and they determined that those genes coalesce back to 990,000 years ago.
Wow.
The Urantia book says the first human beings arrived on the planet 993,408 years ago. So, you know, with this one genetics report from 4 years ago, we have six correlations to the Adam and Eve story.
Wow.
And one correlation to the origins of humanity.
Wow.
Howard, I think it's important to point out for our listeners, too, because you mentioned the date of 1955 when the book was published, but the papers you're talking about, or the papers we're talking about, the history of Urantia, came through in 1935. The book wasn't published, it's true, until 1955, but this information we're speaking of came through, the papers came through in 1935, way before genetics was anywhere near where it is right now. So,
And even in 1955, of course, they weren't anywhere near, you know, like this report just came out 4 years ago. So by any analysis, and it brings up the point that I just mentioned for listeners so that they're clear on this distinction, that, of course, you're absolutely correct that the Urantia book says the material was presented in the mid-1930s and that it, you know, the Urantia book wasn't published until 1955. And because the UB the News project is fundamentally an outreach project that is leveraging this type of credibility to do more effective outreach, all of the reports are based upon corroborations that have occurred after 1955.
Oh.
Because that's, of course, the more conservative date, and it takes a certain leap of faith, if you will, to accept that the material came through in the 1930s. I know for those of us who have been around the Urantia book for a while and have studied the history of the Urantia movement, we can, you know, become quite comfortable with, you know, this type of belief and this type of information. But, of course, to someone who's new to the book, that's well beyond their experience, you know. And so
since we're on the topic, before we finish on the topic of Adam and Eve, I want to just say for people that don't know that that the default of Adam and Eve occurred when, I don't know if we actually mentioned this, when Eve decided to, she thought both her and Adam were dissatisfied with the progress that was being made by the tribe, so Eve decided to mate with a human directly rather than just, you know, having more children and waiting for the children to intermarry, and I guess that was a violation of the plan because they weren't supposed to do that. But what I was going to ask you was this. Since 70% of the population got this microcephalic gene we talked about, I guess what I want to ask you is this. What was the net result or of this genetic contribution that Adam and Eve gave to the human race? In other words, from my understanding of reading the book is that the civilizations or the groups that got more Adamic blood made advances in civilization. Is that pretty accurate or?
That's reasonably fair to say. They migrated out. They were real explorers. They did things. There's no doubt about it. you know, there's so many different specifics we could get into. I kind of hesitate to go into any of them, but, you know, it is fair to say that certainly the descendants of Adam and Eve were very, very influential in the course of human history, and the, you know, and they migrated out from Mesopotamia into, you know, a lot of different parts of the world. I'll just give you one example. The Urantia book says that some of the descendants of Adam and Eve made it by boat across the South Pacific Islands, and that there were more of them up in that time period, that is, there were more islands then than there are today. But that in any case, 132 of them made it by boat to South America and were responsible for the Easter Island civilization and also for the leadership of the Incas. And this is how and why this little extra piece on the microcephalon gene is in quite high percentages among the Native American population, because it was brought through by these people on the boats. what's also interesting to note, of course, is that the two most impressive reports on the UB the News website both have to do with the story of Adam and Eve. We just covered the one about genetics, but the other one has to do with the Garden of Eden.
I was just going
to
ask you about that.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, the Urantia book goes into great detail about where the Garden of Eden was located, what it was shaped like, and the fate of that home, that original home of Adam and Eve. And it says that it existed as a long, narrow peninsula that jutted out off the eastern shores of the Mediterranean Sea, that this peninsula had encircling mountains around it, and that those encircling mountains created a topography that forced the water off of the peninsula onto the mainland of Mesopotamia, up around the area of Syria. And as we have now figured out, the Urantia book doesn't say Syria, it just talks about that it was jutting out off the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. And it says that this peninsula sank to the bottom of the Mediterranean 33,000 years ago, about 4,000 years after Adam and Eve had lived there. And it does parallel the Old Testament account that after they had some trouble, they left that home and started a new home elsewhere. So about 10 years after the Urantia book was published, plate tectonics were invented. And plate tectonic theory was invented. And as well, in the since 1955, we started to get more detailed maps of the Mediterranean basin. And the short of it is simply this. When the Urantia book was published, we didn't have a clear understanding of what the floor of the Mediterranean Sea looked like. It goes down very rapidly on the eastern shore, down about 4,000 feet, very, very quickly. And so, you know, it's hard to map that stuff out. And in fact, it was 1957, 1958 was the International Geophysical Year in which scientists from many nations worked together as a tremendous team to compile a comprehensive portrait of the ocean's floors. And so that's why we got this mapping after, you know, publication. It was in 1955. And, of course, it was just a couple years later that the scientists really got after this issue. And it was this mapping that ultimately led them to the theory of seafloor spreading, and that led to the theory of plate tectonics. And what we see today is that precisely where there's this underwater land mass between Cyprus and Syria that looks exactly like what the Urantia book describes, and it sits right on the edge of three highly active and converging tectonic plates. And so, all of this, works together to show that what the Urantia book describes has, a very high, reasonable degree of probability or accuracy to it, because, the authors of the Urantia book were able to describe topography on the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea that we, you know, didn't know what it looked like back in 1955. And so this is, again, where when the Urantia book says that part of the reason for providing this history is to give us information about epical transactions in the distant past, that, you know, we lost that information. Well, sure enough, here we see that two of the most impressive scientific corroborations of information in the Urantia book have specifically to do with an epical transaction of the distant past, and one that most especially relates very powerful to our story about human origins. And I think that is just, you know, no coincidence, right? That is definitely no coincidence that this particular, of all the stories of human history that could be corroborated by science, the one about Adam and Eve is the most important because that's the one that human beings relate to in terms of their cultural identity, you know, and who they are in the world and where we come from and who is our brother, you know.
Right, right.
Now, what I find interesting, too, Hal, is you correlate the Garden of Eden with modern science, and it's absolutely fascinating. But the story of the Garden of Eden from the Urantia book also correlates very closely with the ancient Samaritan texts, as well as legends like Atlantis. So I find that fascinating, too, that there's also historical accounts that really match up to the story that we're given in the Urantia book about Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden and these legends of gods and goddesses. And, you know, it's just fascinating.
You know, Albert, we have about a half hour left probably, or we can go a little over, but the thing is, I want to just give the number one more time for people. If you want to call in, ask us any questions, 646-716-8158, that's 646-716-8158. Albert, there was also a third revelation, which we touched on briefly earlier in the show, and that was the revelation of Melchizedek. Talk a little bit more about Melchizedek and why he came here, and how he has influenced our concept of monotheism, even up to the present day.
Well, you know, the short of it is that he came and he did his job. You know, he taught that there was one God, and that we were all children of one God, and, you know, today, because so much of the world, at least the Western world, embraces monotheism, you know, we don't necessarily see this in a human historical perspective. But monotheism is a theology that unites people, right? Because of the intense identification that comes with whatever type of theological belief we have, naturally a monotheistic theology is an incredible lever for inspiring people to see the other as the same, that is, that we're all part of the same human family. And so, you know, Melchizedek came to try to upstep the theological disposition of humanity. He came to the part of the world where it was determined this would be the, you know, best hope for advancing monotheism out of the polytheism that humanity was reverting to. There had been, of course, earlier theologic beliefs in monotheism. Of course, Adam and Eve taught that, and Caligastia, and, you know, they all taught that. This had certainly been a part of human history. And while the Urantia book says very clearly that the Jewish people were in no sense a chosen people, it does say that Abraham was a chosen individual. That is, you know, Abraham and Melchizedek, you know, kind of made a deal, right? And that Abraham was to carry forward in his culture and amongst his people the belief in one God, and that is what he did. And this is what prepared humanity in that part of the world to receive Jesus when Jesus came 4,000 years later. And, you know, at the time, I'm not sure that even many of the celestials at high levels knew that Jesus, Michael, our Creator Son, was going to incarnate on this world. But I think at least some of them did. Maybe Paula or Andre, maybe you have a better grasp of the Urantia book on this particular issue than I do about what was known 4,000 years prior to Jesus' bestowal mission.
He did hint at it early on after Adam and Eve even.
Right, yeah. It seems like some of them had a sense of that. And so Melchizedek came to prepare for that and to, you know, make it easier for people to accept Jesus' mission on earth. And, of course, he had mixed results, but certainly his life here did transform our world and continues to do so. And much of the success that his mission has had is directly related to the work that Melchizedek did 4,000 years earlier to prepare the human mind and the human spirit for embracing a monotheistic viewpoint.
I'd like to share a quote if I could, and it's and I want to point out that monotheism is an evolved concept of God, and the Urantia book says that unequivocally, that when a group of humans on a planet come to that point where they embrace monotheism, they have evolved to a higher form of religion. But
right.
This quote is from Jesus. It's from the Jesus Papers, and it touches just on what Halbert was saying about Melchizedek and his teachings to Abraham. It says, "Salvation is the gift of the Father and is revealed by his Son. Acceptance by faith on your part makes you a partaker of the divine nature, a son or a daughter of God. By faith you are justified. By faith you are saved. And by this same faith are you eternally advanced in the way of progressive and divine perfection. By faith was Abraham justified and made aware of salvation by the teachings of Melchizedek. All down through the ages has this same faith saved the sons of men. But now has a son come forth from the Father to make salvation more real and more acceptable." Now, that's a quote from Jesus in the Urantia book.
What page is that on, Paul?
Well, what?
I guess it depends on what version you've got.
1882. It's paper 150, the third preaching tour.
Okay, paper 150. All right. So we know a little bit now about Melchizedek, why he came here, what his purpose was. It's funny, the book, and we talked a little bit, touched on this a little bit earlier. We're talking a little about since we're talking about evolution, one of the things that the Urantia book tells us, this is not unique to the Urantia book, this is also something that was discovered by a lot of liberal Protestant Christians at the time of the 20s and 30s, but the concept of God evolved in the Hebrew mind. Well, I mean, it evolves in every religion, but specifically we'll talk a little bit about the Hebrews. The concept of God evolved from a more primitive concept of God to a more universal, less tribal concept, a more loving concept, and you can see that development, that progressive development, throughout the Old Testament as you read it, as you read the earlier prophets, the later prophets. I guess talk a little bit about that, Halbert, and also tell us, as someone who grew up Jewish, do you find that what the Urantia book says about Judaism and how it evolved, do you find it to be true from your own experience?
You're talking to someone who never really identified much with their Jewish background. I mean,
okay.
I was raised Jewish, but you know, quite frankly, I don't try to represent Judaism or that perspective too much. And one of the, I think, pitfalls in any case is that, like any major religion, there is tremendous diversity within any of the religious traditions. And I think it just does a disservice, you know, to them to try to portray, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Islam, it doesn't matter, Buddhism, all of these different religions that have been around for a long time have remarkable levels of diversity within them. You know, I think one of the more insightful comments I got from Dr. Leon Fine, who teaches world religions at Denison University, where I've done presentations the last several semesters on the Urantia book, because she teaches the Urantia book in the new religions section of her world religions class. And she commented to me that her way of thinking, the more conservative elements of any of the major religions have more in common with each other than they do with the rest of the people in their religion. And same with the more liberal people, you know, in the spectrum of the different religions. The people who are more liberal-minded have more in common with liberal-minded people from other religions than they do with the conservative viewpoint within their own religion. And so I think that, you know, that just, I feel a need to say that, because I don't want to try to misrepresent or offend or mischaracterize the religious tradition that, you know, some people do relate to. Obviously, lots of people relate to being Jewish, and I'm not quite here to speak for that. I think it's important to say simply that the Jewish tradition, obviously, according to the Urantia book, plays a prominent role in the history of humanity. And to get the best contextualized appreciation for that, one, you know, ought to consider checking out the Urantia book's version of this unfolding history. And it's going to naturally have some parallels and similarities to what is in the Jewish tradition and culture, and it's going to have some differences, you know, and that's just as true with the Urantia book's relationship to Christianity, or, you know, commentary that it makes from time to time about the other world religions. You know, there will be similarities and differences, and the Urantia book just says what it says from its own perspective, which is, you know, basically the unfolding of spiritual life on the planet, the evolutionary progressive development of our human spiritual culture. And certainly the Jewish tradition played a very, very prominent role in that unfolding. It was the cultural tradition into which Michael of Nebadon, our Creator Son, incarnated as Jesus of Nazareth.
Well, yeah, and you know what? It's funny because the book, while it rejects the chosen people concept, on the other hand, it also, maybe Paul, you can help us find this quote, I don't know. There's also a place in part four where it kind of says the Jews lost the opportunity to be the light bearers or the truth bearers, you know, to the world when the religious leaders rejected Jesus. And I don't remember exactly how they put it, but so the basic point being that there's not a chosen people per se, no, but the Jews did have a special opportunity to be the ones who would, you know, through which the truth about God and about our universe would be revealed. But they unfortunately, you know, didn't quite.
So
make
up
it
to
there.
That point, Andre, they had been the most progressive religion on earth.
Yes.
And they had a superior family life and a superior culture.
Absolutely.
And that's why you know, Jesus did incarnate within that particular cultural group. But I think it's important to point out that the Urantia book does not hold up any religion or any being anywhere in all of the universe of universes as being more important to God in any way over any other being. God is truly no respecter of persons, and I think that concept is so important for people to understand. The Urantia book makes a proclamation. You know, the history of Urantia gives us this beautiful history of our spiritual striving on this planet. And, of course, the Jewish religion played a huge role in that. But so did many other religions, and the Urantia book covers them as well. And one thing it says, here's a quote that just always touches me because it is so true. The Urantia book was interfaith before anybody even thought of that term. And it says, "The many religions of Urantia are all good to the extent that they bring man to God and bring the realization of the Father to man. It is a fallacy for any group of religionists to conceive of their creed as the truth. Such attitudes bespeak more of theological arrogance than of certainty of faith. There is not a Urantia religion that could not profitably study and assimilate the best of the truths contained in every other faith, for all contain truth. Religionists would do better to borrow the best in their neighbor's living spiritual faith rather than to denounce the worst in their lingering superstitions and outworn rituals." I just think that quote is just, it says it all. We need to learn to accept and embrace the fact that what religion is our search for God and our search to understand the perfection of the Creator. And, you know, from our finite point of view, that's no easy task. And we should embrace the fact that we're all searching, and any search that brings us closer to the truth about God is a good thing. So I think that's important to note.
Yeah. Before I want to make sure before we close here, too, however, that we touch on a very important subject in Part 3. Well, actually, two important subjects. One is there are several papers in Part 3, I think five of them, on the origin and nature of thought adjusters and the mission of thought adjusters.
Yeah.
And the relation of the adjuster to the soul and all these other things. I'm just going to be real basic here. What is a thought adjuster, and why are they here?
Well, the analogy that I like to use it, most people seem to relate to pretty easily, is that there's a physiological parallel to spiritual reality in this respect. That is, God has God's personal being. The Universal Father is a personal deity. But he gives an impersonal part of himself to indwell each of us, to guide us. The indwelling spirit is known as the thought adjuster. And this has parallels in physiology with the genes that we get from our parents. I mean, this is pretty much just how we experience our physical life, is that our parents have their personal being separate and apart from us as their children. But parents give unique genes to each child that uniquely identify them. And if we cooperate with our genetics, you know, eat for our blood type and, you know, work with our genetic makeup on a physical level, then naturally we'll have healthy physical bodies. And similarly, if we work with the indwelling spirit of God, the thought adjuster, that will guide us and bring us into a healthy and robust spiritual life. And so that's how I think about the thought adjusters. They're kind of like the genes we get from our parents, but on a
spiritual
level.
That's a good analogy. I like that.
You're welcome to use it.
Thank you.
I think what it does is it helps us to understand this personal, impersonal aspect, that when we talk about it just in spiritual terms, it can get so almost convoluted, you know, as we get intellectualized about the subject matter or something. But when we bring it home, you know, to our very own experience of life and birth and death and parents and children on a physical level, then, you know, there's this striking parallel. You know,
and
the
certainly
other thing I'd like
all
to...
the concepts of the book that are the most touching and maybe the most important. I think this concept of the thought adjuster, the God within each of us, is probably the most important because it makes religion a personal experience with God in the inner life. And I wonder if you'd be willing to just touch briefly on how that happens. I know the book is very specific on when God comes to be with you and why. And could you touch on that?
Sure. The Urantia book teaches that the indwelling spirit of the thought adjuster arrives when we become sophisticated enough to make our first moral choice, which is typically around 5.5 or 6 years old. That's when a child has developed enough to really be able to choose between right and wrong, to have the cognitive ability and the intellectual sophistication to really begin to understand good and bad, you know, right from wrong. They're not just doing it as a reaction pattern, you know, to please their parents anymore. They're really choosing. And that at that point, the thought adjuster comes and is able to start to work with the evolving personality of that individual before a mind develops in a child to that level of sophistication. There simply isn't anything for a thought adjuster to do because thought adjusters are here to spiritualize our thinking and develop our spiritual life. And until we can make choices on a spiritual level, well, you know, there's just nothing to do. So that's when they arrive. And they function in three distinct phases, roughly from that 6 years old to around 20 years old. They're referred to as thought changers, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. And then from 20 to 40, thought adjusters. And then from 40 on, thought controllers. And these refer to distinct aspects of our development as spiritual beings. In this way, it might be said that the Urantia book's theology supports our sort of pop psychology perspective that around 40 years old, there's a shift in people, and it spans the range from midlife crisis to life begins at 40 and everything in between, perhaps. But, you know, something happens around that age, and the way I personally relate to it is that I think that basically that period from about 20 to 40 years old is when we're creating our adulthood, we're creating our adult identity, if you will. And that after doing that for about 20 years old, for 20 years, you know, and we get up to around 40 years old, we're able to look back and reflect and realize, you know, I kind of am who I am, and now is the time to make the most of that. You know, it's not time so much to create my adulthood. I've done that for 20 years. Now it's time to enhance and grow and mature my adult identity. And this has a, you know, I think a spiritual counterpart to it, if you will, or a spiritual aspect that's reflected in the way the Urantia book talks about the evolving nature of the thought adjuster's relationship to our minds through our developmental stages as human beings. You know, we've got sort of our pre-adult phase, then we've got the first phase of our adulthood, and then we've got the matured phase of our adulthood.
Albert, I want to just, before we go, I want to make sure we get at least one more point in here, and that is the Part 3 also has some papers on what is known as the Supreme Being.
Yeah.
That is an aspect of God that the Urantia book reveals to us. What is the Supreme Being, and what's that about? It's not just another name for God. It's a particular aspect of God that the book reveals.
Right.
Who is the Supreme Being?
I think...
Well, Halbert could do a whole show on the Supreme Being, so let's just that clear right up front. Go ahead, Hal.
I'd like to summarize it this way. You know, the Urantia book talks about God in the first part of the book quite extensively, so let's ask why would this aspect of deity, this aspect of God, be reserved for the very very end of this section about the history of Urantia. And as I understand it, the answer is that, or one way to express an answer for that question is that the Supreme Being is, if you will, evolutionary deity. That is, that's the part of God that grows. That's the part of God that becomes enriched through the experiences of his children. So it's not that God changes, but because we change, then we are providing something in the universe for God to relate to, that God couldn't relate to it and be part of that with us until we came along and did stuff. You know, God may be eternal, but we're not yet. You know, or we're, you know, evolving towards that. And so the Supreme Being is that part of God that, you might say, grows along with us. And so I think it comes at the end of this third section of the book because it is the deity complement to the human evolutionary experience. And the Urantia book has a lot more to say about that, but as Paula said, it is a big subject, and, you know, I'd probably just like to leave it encapsulated like that.
Mm. It's a rich subject.
It is. It's a very rich subject. But one thing I would like to do before we close off, since the You Be the News project is has most of its reports related to this section of the Urantia book, I'd like to just very quickly, I think I can do it in probably about 60 to 90 seconds, encapsulate the different reports that relate to this third section of the book. Of course, two of them we've already talked about, the Adam and Eve report and the Garden of Eden report, so there's nothing more really to say on that. But I'd also like to mention that there's a report on the early migration to the Americas of the Native Americans. The Urantia book says they came 85,000 years ago across the Bering Strait land bridge, and we're increasingly corroborating that. It was at about 12,000 years is what scholarship believed in 1955, and that's been pushed back to about 50,000 years now, roughly. There's also a report called Pangaea to Plate Tectonics that relates to the Urantia book's assertion that the land masses used to be one enormous continent that then broke up due to continental drift. And so this is part of the geologic history of the Urantia book that has been very much supported after its publication in 1955 because plate tectonics is what gave credibility to continental drift. There's a report on the Sierra Mountains being 50 years old. Just in the last couple years, some very powerful research was done, very credible research was done that is helping to end a controversy about the age of the Sierra Mountains as to whether they're 5 million years old or 50 million years old, and this new research comes down supporting what the Urantia book said, that they're 50 million years old and more even. There's also a report about when the Vikings first came to the North American continent. The Urantia book says that they arrived around 1000 AD, but it wasn't until the 60s that we actually excavated the first Viking settlement in North America. And before then, it was just folklore that they had arrived in North America, and there wasn't a shred of physical evidence until after the Urantia book was published. I think that basically... Oh, you know, I also mentioned one other thing, that this is a little bit outside of Section 3, but it's a great example of how people sometimes confound issues of science and history when it relates to the Urantia book because they can become so intertwined. The Urantia book says that a supernova that occurred about 500 years ago, and you could see the light in the daytime sky and all of this, that it had its origins as a double star nova, or a double star supernova. And this has been corroborated after the Urantia book's publication, and it takes a lot of science to do this kind of stuff, to get this type of corroboration, so much so that we sometimes tend to just think about it in straight scientific terms. But even this is an example of history. You know, the Urantia book is reporting a fact that this supernova had a certain type of origin, and that's an historic fact, even though it takes great advances in the sciences to corroborate that historic fact. And a lot of these issues have that type of, you know, interrelationship between the science and the history. But I think this third section of the Urantia book is really going to become a standout section in the years to come, because this is where we get the vast majority of our, maybe vast majority is a little of an overstatement, but this is where we're getting the majority of our corroborations about the validity of the Urantia book's information in an objective, verifiable way. And one thing I'd just perhaps like to close with in kind of response to something Paula said earlier that I really resonated with when she talked about how, you know, this third section of the Urantia book is just rich. I mean, there's so much to get out of it, and you don't have to have it verified by science in order to get a bunch of, you know, insightful, inspiring information from it. But I think one thing we tend to forget as Urantia book readers is that pretty much all of us have tended to be people who, as I put it, dance at the end of the bell curve. That is, there's a reason why most people over the last 50 years have not taken a great interest in the Urantia book. And some people have, and it's been growing, and it's been growing just fine. But still, the majority of the population hasn't really appreciated the text. And I think this aspect of credibility is the key reason. Every charlatan salesperson who can afford an infomercial knows to spend a significant amount of time talking about how 4 out of 5 dentists recommend, or independent studies show, or new science reveals support for their product. And they know that people won't, quote-unquote, buy it unless they're able to document this type of objective, verifiable, independent quality to it, you know, independently studied quality. And I think that this is what we're looking at with the Urantia book in the decades to come, is an opportunity that we've just never seen before, an opportunity to really intrigue and inspire people about the information in the Urantia book, because we're able to say to them that increasingly there's an emerging pattern of credibility with this book that is absolutely unique on the planet. There is no other text in the world that is so richly detailed in so many aspects of both science and history, and exhibits the unique pattern of having science and scholarship catch up to it. And that does resonate with people, to say that and to be able to back it up. And the good news about the Internet and the technological age that we're in today is that we don't have to all be the scholars who have memorized all these details about how science is caught up to the Urantia book here or there and on that subject or this subject. Obviously, there's aspects of the Urantia book that are much, much more valuable and insightful and inspiring than the particular ways that science has corroborated this bit of information or that bit of information. But these verifications are what give people that sense of credibility, that foundation of credibility that makes them comfortable with venturing in to the rest of the book, and intrigues and inspires them to, you know, take a closer look at it. And the good thing about the ubthenews.com website is this is something that we can simply reference when we're talking to people about the Urantia book. When we assert this unique quality of credibility and tell them where they can get the information free anytime they want, and that there's even topic summaries so that they can, you know, just review it all in 5 or 10 minutes and get the gist of it, then we're giving people an inroad into the Urantia book's credibility and telling them how they can get it for themselves. And then we can go on and talk about all those other things that are really more important, you know, and of greater value than these.
And I think, and I think, Albert, too, that faith is not something that needs to be blind. Faith is supported by logic and evidence. And if you have evidence and logic that can, you know, bolster your claim, that will, you know, it can increase someone's faith. I'm not, and I realize that you can't prove God exists. That's not what I'm talking about.
Of course.
I'm just saying faith in the authenticity of this revelation. Albert, I want to thank you for being on our show.
Before you close, Andre, I think it's important that Albert spell out UP News, because some people, I just imagine they're going to be out there going, Y-O-U.
Oh, bless your heart.
So,
that's right.
Yes, please do that, Hal.
It's UB, abbreviation for Urantia Book, the letter U, the letter B, T-H-E, the N-E-W-S News, UB, the News, so UBTHENEWS.com. Thank you, Paula, for that.
Thank you.
Very sweet.
And thank you for that service, Albert. It's a wonderful service, and certainly people do need things to be credible. I mean, they need to believe that something is credible or test it out, and that is an invaluable service that you perform for the Urantia movement. Thank you so much.
And, you know, one thing, thank you, Paula, but I also want to add to that, because sometimes as Urantia book readers, we really forget this aspect of things, and Andre's comments a moment ago sort of reminded me of this. The Urantia book talks about what it means to be an agendonter, to believe without seeing, and that this kind of special status in spiritual life occurs when you have a rebellion and then, you know, the spiritual administrators aren't there anymore to do their job and so forth. But it is the nature of epical revelations, which are a natural part of all evolutionary mortal spheres. It is their nature to make sure that agendonter status never occurs, is one way of putting it. Agendonter status is the exception, not the rule. Epical revelations, by their nature, tend to have or do have a superhuman quality of credibility associated with them. You know, the planetary prince, Caligastra, had a staff of 100 who were immortal. Well, that speaks of credibility. Adam and Eve were immortal, 8 feet tall, and violet. Well, you know, there's some credibility for you. Even Melchizedek came without lineage and left mysteriously. Jesus, of course, performed all kinds of miracles, even to the resurrection of the dead and his own resurrection. What's fascinating about this epical revelation is that we as human beings have to play a role in creating this superhuman quality of credibility. And I think it's just one of the most outrageous opportunities that has ever been dished out to mortals, is to have an epical revelation about which, in order to have a superhuman quality of credibility attached to it, we have to do the work. We can't just show up and see it and go, oh yeah, superhuman, right? We have to... Well, I mean, but not in an objective, verifiable way. We may recognize it internally, spiritually, as many of us have, and that's a beautiful and wonderful thing. But on this objective, verifiable level, you know, that's where, that's really what I'm talking about. I mean, because obviously, for instance, take the Caligastra planetary prince time period. Well, when he first showed up, before those beings had lived generation after generation, the staff of 100, it was not so apparent that they were immortal, right? You know,
That's right.
It took some time, right? So these do have an evolving nature about them. I don't mean to overstate it, and I certainly respect the point you're making that ultimately, you know, this isn't about proving anything, but it is just to say that there's some very unique opportunities here with the Urantia book and regarding this issue of, you know, what an epical revelation provides us in relationship to agendonter status and how that also is an evolving, changing dynamic in the course of our human affairs.
And my only point is that there's always a faith element too.
Yep.
You have to take some things on faith. There's no way to prove them. You just
yes.
have to believe.
Yep.
And with Jesus, with Melchizedek, with Adam and Eve, with Caligastia, with the Urantia book, with you and I, with the whole unseen realm, all of our celestial friends who, you know, we know, you know, I know, Andre knows, they're there. We feel them. We experience them. But not everybody would believe that. And that's faith. I can't prove that God exists. There's no argument I can make to you or anybody that God exists if you're not inclined to believe it.
But the thing that's so great about the Urantia book to me is that faith is not, in the book, I don't think faith is arbitrary. You know, it's like, as I said, it's based on logic and evidence. We don't know for sure that the sun's going to rise tomorrow morning, but we know, you know, we go from logic and evidence that it will, and we base our faith on that. So faith is not a leap in the dark. It's not.
Yeah, and I want to be very clear in case it's misunderstood by listeners. The You Be the News project is not about proving the authenticity of the Urantia book. It is about establishing its unique quality of credibility. Credibility is not the same as proof.
Yes.
In no way do these correlations and corroborations that are emerging, in no way do they prove the origins or authenticity of the Urantia book. They don't prove anything about anything else that's said in the Urantia book. They just are what they are. You know, they're just us catching up to the information in the Urantia book and recognizing that certain things it says are true, even though we didn't know that when it was published, for whatever that is worth. But it's certainly not a proof, and I don't want anyone to misconstrue the project or my understanding in that way. I regularly instruct people that, you know, that is not what the project is about, and that's not what these reports are about. The distinction between credibility and proof is a very important one.
Like truth and
respect. Yeah, it is, because of just what the two of you have said, that ultimately we need to be faithful, and that is the bottom line. We really need to be faithful.
Yeah.
Especially on this planet.
Yes, especially on this one. It takes a busload of faith to get by.
You guys, I need to get off here, but
okay.
But again, if anybody wants to go to Halvard's site, it is ubthenews.com. That's ubthenews.com. And thank you, Halvard, for all your insights into Part 3, and thank you for giving us some information that we might not otherwise have gotten about how Part 3 correlates to how there have been certain scientific discoveries that are confirming many of the things that we know to be true from the Urantia book. So, again,
thank you,
Hal. Great job. Thank you.
Thanks, Paula. Thanks, Andre.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Andre?
I'm here.
Okay, I guess that's it for this one. It's a
wrap. That is it for this one. So we just need to play our disclaimer and let everybody know that next week we'll be talking about our dear Lord and Savior and Sovereign Jesus Christ Michael, and we'll be doing that with Preston Thomas. I just spoke with him today. He'll be talking to us about Part 4. Next week, that should be a great show. And so thanks a lot for listening, and thanks for being with me.
And also, Andre, really quickly, you can get the Urantia book at Amazon.com, and it's available all over the Internet. It's available at bookstores. It's available in libraries. Pick one up and read it.